I think about it was about a month ago, maybe a little longer, but not too much, that the two presidential campaigns, the Republicans and the Democrats in the United States, were accusing each other of being weird. Remember that at all? Both sides were trying to convince the American public that the other side's candidate was weird. No, they're weird. No, you're weird. No, you're weird. And it seems that being weird is something that turns people off. Now, you may think I'm a bit eccentric for the shirts I wear. Is that possible? You may think that somebody's outlandish in their style, maybe walking against the stream a bit, walking to their own drum, moving against the stream. And I think most of us are fairly tolerant. That's okay, but being weird and strange and bizarre, that is not good, is it? That's probably one title we don't want to carry for ourselves. You're weird. No one seems to want that label. No one wants to be known as strange, bizarre, freaky, unnatural. Because that's the underlying tone to it, unnatural. And all the political candidates were trying to put the label weird upon the other person, on their opponents, hoping that it didn't stick to them. Now that got me thinking about when Brenda Higgins called my wife Sally her BFF. Because that seemed kind of strange to me, a little bit weird that a grown woman would call another grown woman her best friend forever. Kids do that at times, don't they? They do that. My daughter Elizabeth had BFF bracelets that she shared with friends. But I found out later that's not exactly what Brenda meant when she called Sally her BFF. So I've invited Sally and Brenda to come up and tell us a little bit about what BFF stands for. What did you mean when you called Sally your BFF, Brenda?
Well, I was over at Sally's house one night. We were just having a little visit, and I said to her,
Keep it up.
"You're my BFF," and she said, "What does that mean?" And I said, "Flaky, my best flaky friend," and because we were trying to think of what I said, I really want to pray. I teach school, kindergarten, and I said, oh, I really want to pray on the first day of school. I really want to pray for my students and for the whole faculty. And I said, but I don't want to seem, and Sally said, like, what? Like, weird?
Flaky.
Flaky. So that's how, we got the flaky. So every time I see BFF, I'm thinking, yeah, everybody thinks it's your best friend forever, which she is my best friend forever. But flaky was in there because we didn't want to seem weird, as Mark said. But like, how comfortable do you feel when you walk up to a friend and say, "Can I pray for you?" Or, "I feel like praying for you," or, "I'm going to take a moment and pray." But the only people that I feel comfortable doing that is with people who come to church with me, who I know, who I feel safe at. So yeah. I need to have the courage to be flaky outside of my church community.
Yeah. And Sally, you were commenting to me, I think, at one point about just the challenge of pushing past the barrier and being willing to share one's faith in various ways, right? Through prayer, through testimony, through various forms, that's crossing that threshold is very challenging. Do you got any thoughts about that?
It takes being vulnerable because you never know how you're going to be, how it's going to be received. And so often, because I was one of these people before I was a believer, so often people think, well, I believe many people think this, if you are desperate enough to believe in something that you can't see, Jesus Christ, God, the Holy Spirit, then you really must be desperate. And I don't like being thought of in those terms.
Yeah. So the challenge of one of the beautiful parts here at church is we get to come here and we can share our faith with each other, right? And we can pray for each other. Although there's still some reserve among some of us here, even in the church, right? We're a little bit shy with each other about praying for each other or asking for prayer, for that matter. It kind of goes back to, you know, what Earlene was talking about a bit earlier, where prayer chain, but for the prayer chain to work, people have to ask for prayer. And that's not easy to do in itself, to be that vulnerable. So both the giving and receiving of our faith is a challenge for many of us, because the world has taught us that when we believe in something that we cannot touch or see, that we cannot objectively prove is true, we might have good reasons to believe it, but we can't believe that there's something deficient in us for believing that. So, okay, that's good, that's it. So, best flaky friends, okay. I'm thinking that maybe you might be open to having a few more best flaky friends in your life. Yeah, good. Now that's the pitch today. The unchurched world out there sees those of us who have a real faith as flaky. Or even worse, as Sally was saying, of spineless, desperate, needy people who possibly can't make it on their own. We're tagged with this descriptor, weird. You know, you're kind of weird coming to church today. Do you know that about yourselves? You're actually in the minority today. A small minority, really, compared to what it used to be like. The whole movement against religion generally and Christianity in particular goes back a couple hundred years in Western culture. For instance, Karl Marx said that religion was the opiate of the masses. People who are looking for a sense of security and salvation in the face of the uncertainty of life. Marx felt that religion taught individuals to focus on otherworldly concerns and not on the immediate poverty of their present suffering. Religion, as far as Marx was concerned, was a form of escapism. Freud considered God to be a fantasy based on the infantile need for a dominant father figure. Religion was a necessity in our development in early civilizations to help restrain our violent impulses. But he said now can be discarded. Religion can be discarded as we move in favor of science and reason. And this kind of thinking has infiltrated Western culture in so many different guises. It's affected people in so many different ways. It's shaped us. Even those of us who are believers have grown up in a culture that doesn't really welcome intellectually our faith, to the point that it's become a major barrier for people to cross if they want to explore a religious point of view in life. You got to risk the possibility of weirdness in order to come to church now. And let's face it, people don't want to be tagged as weird. None of us want to be tagged as weird. And I think one of the proofs that I would present to you that this is true is take a look, if you're old enough, at your own children. And if you don't have children, look at that younger generations that are coming after you. Do they think you're kind of weird because you go to church? Do they think you're kind of weird for being even remotely religious? For having an active faith life? What do they think about you for that? Or is this something you just don't talk about with them? You just agree this is a topic you're not going to share with your children. You're going to avoid the topic. But that's another kind of signal along the same line of evidence. What about your friends or your work colleagues? People you share an activity with. What do they think about your faith life? What do they think about your church involvement? Have you even shared that part of yourself with them? One of my friends that I have a shared hobby with one time just made the off company thought my religious faith was a crutch, a fantasy, nonsense. I bit my tongue in that moment. I think he sees my religious life as a bit weird, to be honest. I think many people today who have a faith life are a bit embarrassed by it. We keep it hidden for fear that someone will think that we're flaky or even worse, weird or bizarre. And if we look back 60 years ago when I was just a little kid, only 60 years ago, most people in Canada went to church on a Sunday morning. I think 1965 was the peak year of attendance for the United Church of Canada. And 80% of the Canadian population was affiliated with a faith community back in those days. It was the default common practice for people. It was weird not to go to church. And in 1965, CBS struggled greatly with whether to move forward with the Charlie Brown Christmas special. Most of you have seen that, I imagine? I wonder if some of the younger folk have seen Charlie Brown Christmas special. Charlie Brown was a comic strip created by Charles Schulz. He created this wonderful comic strip that ran for decades long. It had a huge following. It's Charlie Brown, Snoopy, Lucy, Linus, you know, the gang of characters that was part of that strip. And CBS wanted Schulz to produce a Charlie Brown Christmas special. But they were completely taken aback when Schulz came to them with a religious-based story. Why? Because CBS didn't want to be perceived as weird. And putting a religious-based story on network TV was a bridge in some ways too far for them to go. And what would people think about CBS? What would they think about them as a network if they put a religious-based story in the main time slot? And this was during a time in society when going to church was common practice. It was mainstream to be part of religion. Why would in 1965 CBS worried about being perceived weird by putting a Charlie Brown Christmas special that had a religious theme to the story? Why would that even cross their minds in 1965? See, but right at the moment when churches were packed full of people, stuffed full of people, they were bursting at the seams, the intellectual forces in our culture were against religion and faith had come to their peak. And in learned circles, through university settings and intellectual societies, in main leadership roles in business, being religious was considered, even in those days, as being flaky, a bit weird, perhaps a lot weird. And you can see this in the Charlie Brown Christmas special. The whole story is about Charlie Brown's religious impulse being seen by others as weird. He's perceived by all his compatriot children as being weird because he wants the religious story as part of his Christmas celebration. That's what the underlying struggle of that 25-minute show is about. Charlie Brown just can't embrace the non-religious impulse that's found in the Christmas season of his culture. He wants the real deal. Charlie Brown wants to know the deeper meaning of Christmas, and he has to ask someone to explain it to him. He has to ask someone to explain to him the meaning of Christmas. And this is in 1965 when pretty much everyone went to church. How is it possible that Charlie Brown doesn't already know the answer? Have you ever wondered about that? Why doesn't he know the answer already? See, the intellectual case against God was at its most formidable point in Western thinking back in the 1950s and 60s. Basically, the idea goes like this. The more we advance in our scientific knowledge, the less space there is for God. God's territory keeps shrinking as human knowledge increases. We don't need God anymore, it seems. It seems that Freud was right after all. We can turn away from religion and move towards science and reason in our human pursuits. And even in 1965, with churches full of people, anyone who hung on to a real and vital belief in God was simply fooling themselves, was going against the intellectual culture of the time. And proof of this, if you want proof of this, is you just have to look a year later, on April 8th, 1966, there was a Time cover called, you can put it up there, Dave, for us. Our system's a little slow. This was the cover of the Time, Weekly Time magazine, April 8th, 1966, Is God Dead? Is God Dead? Some of you probably remember that title coming out. And this was at the height of church attendance. The culture was, at the time, the cultural practice was to go to church. How could God be dead when churches were full? See, it's taken about 100 or 200 years for the case against God to filter out into the general public. We're living with the fruits of what was being articulated back in 1966. And we see it in our church communities today. We see it in our diminished numbers. We see it in the tepid faith of our members. We see it in our shy disposition. We see it in our self-imposed restraints with others. Jesus told us as his disciples to boldly go out and make new disciples of all the nations. But the typical United Church doesn't know how to disciple people anymore. We used to know. We used to know how to do this very well. There's history in this church that proves that we knew how to disciple people. Evangelism has become a dirty word in our tradition. And we've lost confidence in our take on life as followers of Jesus Christ. And I think the primary reason for this is that deep down we believe that the case against God is overwhelming. We might personally believe that there is a God. We might hope there is a God even. But we think the case for the existence of God is weak, very weak. So we don't want to draw attention to ourselves. We don't want to expose our weakness to others. We don't want to risk being seen in the world as weird for believing something that has so little evidence to support it. And the irony of all this is that over the past 60 years, the case for God has gotten stronger. The space for God has been growing over the last 60 years. The case for the Christian witness for Jesus is more secure today than it's been in hundreds of years. And even though religious practice and affiliation is lower, the intellectual foundation for God is in better shape today than it has been in for at least the last 100, probably 200 years. And we might say that the turning point came back in 1969 with another Times front cover. Only 3 years after the Times front page title said, "Is God Dead?" there's another title titled, we got it there, "Is God Coming Back to Life?" See, belief in religion and belief in religious practice wasn't dying off after all. Just 3 years, that's the turning point. Somewhere in those 3 years, the culture shifted. The intellectual culture. And over the past 60 years, advancements in scientific knowledge has made the case for God stronger, not weaker. Science has expanded the space for God, not shrunk it down further. Advancements in historical research has made the Christian story more believable, not less. Advancements in philosophical reasoning has opened up new pathways for us to believe in God. For instance, the more we study life, the more we understand the phenomenal complexity of even the simplest cell, the more remarkable the origin of life becomes to us. How did that first life happen? Back in the 1950s, scientists still didn't understand the basic building blocks of life. Today, we understand that life rests in big part on a complex coding system. Today, the question today is, where did this complex coding system that's found at the very center of cellular life, where did it come from? Where did it come from? It's becoming less and less plausible that it just created itself, just popped into existence through natural processes. That's becoming more and more unlikely the more we study the mystery of the simplest life. Back in the 1950s, most cosmologists and astrophysicists believed in an eternal universe. Today, the mainstream view in science is that the universe had a finite beginning long, long time ago. Way back in time, it began. And if the universe began to exist, the question then comes, well, what gave rise to it, to its existence? What gave rise to it? Because everything that exists has a cause, and if the universe began to exist, then what was the cause of the universe? What is the cause? Who is the cause? We got new understandings in philosophy that have made belief in God more tenable, new historical methods that have made the gospel accounts more reliable to us. On a practical level, we just look around in our culture and we see this growing level of anxiety and depression in people. And there's a direct correlation between the decline in religiosity in our culture and the rise of depression and anxiety. And I think it's a reasonable inference to see them connected to each other. It's a reasonable inference to suggest that the growing anxiety and depression in people that we see around us is the result of a lack of belief in a higher power of some sort. And a mighty purpose that comes from from knowing and believing in this higher power. When I listen to mental health practitioners, I never, ever hear them mention anything about religious practice or religious belief, ever hear about that. When they're talking about depression and anxiety, it's almost like they've taken a vow of silence and they've removed from the conversation the one element that I think could provide the biggest blessing to our population. In all fairness, that's not their job, is it? It's not their job to make the claim in a belief in God or belief in Jesus. That's our job as a church community. It's the job of all churches around Canada, around the world. It's our job to make the claim that our happiness and our peace rests on a relationship with our Creator. It's our job to share this news with other people. It's not their job. It's our job as Jesus' church to share the knowledge of God with other people and to share the way of Jesus with people. But if we're too afraid of seeming weird, we'll never speak up. I'm here to tell you, and you don't have to trust me on this, but I'm here to tell you that you're not weird for believing in God. You're not weird. You're not weird for believing in the presence of Jesus Christ here in this service. You're not weird for this. And you're not weird for believing in miracles. And you're not weird for resting on the love of God in your life. You're not weird for resting on God's love for you, for all people. That's not weird at all. I'm saying to you that it's the grounding of life to rest yourself on the truth. And it's our job as disciples, to disciple other people into the knowledge that God has revealed to us in Jesus. We can't outsource this to anyone. No one else will do it for us anyway. If we wait for mental health practitioners and medical doctors and cosmologists and biologists to disciple people to a life of faith, it's never going to happen. And it seems to me that if we are to disciple people into a life of faith, then we need to deeply understand what it is we believe. You can't guide people into something you don't know yourself. So we need to know it well. We need to know what we believe, and we need to know why we believe it. And we need to really wrestle with our doubts and uncertainties about it, too. Because there's no way growing up in this culture that all of us today don't have significant doubts and uncertainties. And if there's one thing in this point in Trillium's development as a church of Jesus, if there's one thing in all the development of our church at this time that I could ask from you, it would be that you go through the Alpha program. That would be the greatest blessing that you could bring to Trillium today. Why Alpha? The Alpha program lays out the core Christian teachings, what C.S. Lewis calls mere Christianity, and in an easy and accessible manner. It's so beautifully laid out in a way that we can understand. Alpha gives a person the opportunity to reflect on the essential elements of the Christian faith. It helps clarify what one believes and why one believes it. And if you don't accept what Alpha is suggesting, it will at least explain to you why you don't agree with the basic tenets of Christian faith, too. And I'm thinking Alpha today is now more important than stepping up onto a committee, church committee. It's more important than leading a new program at Trillium. It's more important than increasing your financial offerings on the plate. Did I just say that? Yeah, sorry. It is, though. It is. It's the greatest blessing you could bring to our church to come to a clear understanding of what you believe and especially why you believe it. That's so important today. You got to know why you believe it, so that you can better understand and then better able to explain your Christian faith to yourself and to others in a clear and simple manner. That's what Paul was doing on the Areopagus on Mars Hill. That's what I like to call it, on Mars Hill in central Athens. He's at the central he's at the intellectual capital of the world. Ancient Athens at this time was the ancient intellectual capital of the world. He was right at the center point on Mars Hill. He's engaging his world through his Christian faith. And if we think we have a tough time today in Canada explaining and communicating our faith to others, Paul had a much harder task at his time. There was no give on the part of the Stoic and Epicurean philosophers of his day. There was no shared cultural inheritance to draw upon, no common ground with them. And there was no doubt that these Greek intellectuals were finding Paul's claims weird. What is this babbler trying to say to us? He seems to be advocating foreign gods, that is, foreign ideas that we don't understand. That's how the Christian gospel sounded to them, some strange and bizarre form of teaching. You're bringing us some strange, some weird ideas, Paul, today. We're going to try to understand you, but it's weird. And that's how the gospel is going to sound at first to so many in our culture today. It's going to sound strange and weird to them, just like it did in Paul's time. It's going to sound strange and weird to your children and your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren. It's going to sound weird to your work colleagues. It's going to sound weird to your neighbors. The people we hang out with, my friends, your friends, it's going to sound weird to them. The gospel is going to sound weird to them, and there's no way of getting around this. And that may mean also that they think we're weird too. So we need to be very confident that what we are saying in truth is not weird at all. You need to be confident to know that what you're saying is not weird. It's not weird. Because people are going to tell you that it is. In fact, I would suggest that our faith makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense about the world that we live in. But to really live out this confidence with others, we need to know our basic Christian beliefs well. And we need to know again why we believe them to be true. And as I mentioned to you, the best way that I know of coming to this knowledge for us as average people is going through the Alpha program. See, we are a community of BFFs, best flaky friends, right? Let's embrace this understanding of each other. I want you to be my BFF today. Do you want me to be your BFF? Well, you'll have to let me know. Let's embrace this understanding with each other. Learn together in a deeper way what it means to celebrate the presence of God in our lives and to welcome the Spirit of Jesus into our hearts, because that's where the real knowledge of our faith takes hold. Father, let your kingdom come. Father, let your will be done on earth as in heaven, right here in my heart. Do you think I'm weird singing during a sermon? Well, if you do, I'm okay with that.